cheers, Luto won. Don't forget, my friends, you destroyed evidence. I'll write it in, show you're wrong, cite the good case law to the judgment it comes. I write my motion all night, gripping my pen so tight. Conferred, something's still not right. This is going to trial. No delay, no more lies, no invasive answers, and no continuance. Yeah. Fight my emotion all night, gripping my pen so tight.
This is our it's our law motion department singing this one.
Yeah.
What's your appeals department doing? Cry?
I guess. So that is and was our law and motion department, Travis Davis, singing Metallica. Metallica. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this episode of the podcast. We have a very special edition, and we're filming New Year's Eve. So those of you that are tuning in and seeing us on the YouTube channel, we're a little formal here today, gentlemen. And, you know, I also wear it out of respect for our very special guest because we have a master's panel. We're talking to two gentlemen that will be on the Law de Gras coming up. Will be next month by the time this airs. But, you know, first I want to introduce on our master's panel, we have two gentlemen, highly distinguished. To my right, we have Gary Dordick, who is my mentor, and I might get into the story of how I got to the honor of meeting him. But Gary has the biggest verdicts up and down the state, mentor to so many people, not only as a lawyer, but as a human being, multiple trial lawyer of the year, but mostly a human of the year. Gary, why don't you give the listeners a quick hello?
Thank you very much. Good morning, gentlemen. At first, when I woke up, I thought, is this how I want to spend the last day of the year working? And the truth is, my dear friend Chris Dolan, Bob Simon, there's no place I would rather be than with you gentlemen. Good morning.
Wow, and we haven't even served the alcohol yet, Mr. Dory. So the gentleman to my left, he has one of the most outstanding reputations as a consumer advocate. And I say that not with just... you know, it's not just words, because what Chris Dolan has meant for the community of lawyers, what he does transcends law, because he also makes policy. And I think it's very important. A lot of people don't understand. Chris has some of the biggest verdicts. He has been consumer attorney of the year up and down the state. But most importantly, you have initiated change. I mean, not a lot of people can say that. So, you know, Chris, welcome from up north. Thanks for flying down today with you, your family, Jack and Audrey, your two little ones. So say a few words about being here.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's important, this whole thing about change. Some people are only stuck in the dollars. I also like the change. So as I've told you before, that a case needs to have one of the three P's to be taken in my office. It has to either make me a profit, affect the policy, or piss me off. The third is always happening generally, but I try to pair one with a profit. But as Gary will tell you, not always the case. And it's not that important to me, really. Sometimes it's about making lasting change.
And I think a lot of our listeners, when they hear your name, they'll see some of the verdicts, you know, high dollar figures. But sometimes they see these cases, and then the ones that you win, and they say, oh, my God, why did he even have that case? Was it because of number three?
Gary says that all the time. You know, really, part of it is I'll be quite honest with you. I think that I've been blessed with a certain amount of talent. I've been blessed with a certain amount of success. And I believe at times that we're called upon to do things other than just the big value cases. So it's my own kind of personal path, but I think that God every now and then wants you to take care of somebody that nobody else is going to take care of.
I love it. So we always start off our Justice Team podcasts with, and by the way, you always can email questions to media@justiceteam.com, but we have Jenny Anglin, who's going to serve us some drinks to get us started here for the next hour while we get to give you guys some good advice. Jenny, what do we have back there? What's going on?
Okay, well, I'm going a little light this morning.
I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, and my sister gave me actually this bottle for Christmas. It's appropriate because Chris is here. It's King in the North, and it's a porter. Ah. So it's in honor of you. So this is for you and Gary.
Thank you.
And I don't know if it's any good, but I mean,
ooh, we also have okay. Mother of Dragons.
These are my private stock glasses that I brought for you. Sorry, Gary, you have to drink for the Mother of Dragons.
I think of her fondly.
And Bob, you've got Winter is Coming. Ooh. On yours. I think that's what this is. Yeah. Or is it Winter is Here?
Winter is Here.
And then and then this is another one of my special glasses for you, Chris. This is we got some kombucha for you, and that's because Bob told me that there's a story behind this phrase, 1% for justice.
There is.
Can
indeed.
You tell us what that is?
So I've been blessed to do a number of punitive damage trials. And trying to find out a way to get a jury to think about what's appropriate, what should this company be held to pay so that it would make a difference. And if you just throw out a number without having it grounded to something, I think that it becomes suspect to the jury. So when I was doing a punitive damage case against FedEx, I thought up this idea and I said, well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, I've got $100 bills in my briefcase, but if I pull them out, he's going to object. We're going to get caught up in about 5 or 10 minutes, so I'm going to paint you a word picture. I said, imagine $100 bills. And if you think about that, and that's what their net worth is, okay? This is what they're worth. So if you take one of them off the top, is it going to put that company out of business? Is it going to cause them to fire any workers? No, but is 1% from a $2.7 billion company to get somebody's attention? You bet. And I said, that's the only way you can get these people's attention, is by taking something away from them that they love more than justice. So what I'm telling you is I want 1% for justice. And I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $24.9 million for each of my clients. Wow. They rounded up to 25.
How nice.
I said, thank you.
So thanks. So Jenny has a trial starting next week. Well, this week. So she has to get out of here.
Yeah.
So usually she stays behind the bar, gives us some refills. But Jenny, get out of here.
Okay.
If you have better things.
Here's the bottle if you need more.
All right. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So some of the things that the listeners want to, I mean, most listeners are well, you know, acquainted with who you guys are, what you've done. But a lot of people don't know the background of who you are. So I want to start, and I'm going to start with Gary. I want you to educate the listeners of kind of who you are and how you got there. I think it's an important lesson because everybody thinks they can get up out of bed and do what you do, but I think it starts earlier on when you're maybe a teenager, maybe sometimes earlier than that. But how did you get to where you are? What drives you?
I think the questions actually compound.
No. There's no objections here.
All right.
It's Nava who makes him get out of bed every morning.
Yeah. You know, I wish I had a story where I was wronged as a child and decided to fight for people's rights. And I wish it was, I don't really have one of those stories about how I became a lawyer, other than to say that I was a martial arts instructor teaching full time, literally going completely broke after high school. I didn't go to college and it wasn't going particularly well, but I was in very good shape. That's about what I had. And I ended up making coffee for a law firm. I was doing filing and making coffee, and the owner of the law firm, Donald Kotler, came to me after about 6 months and was pleased with how I was doing and gave me a job doing investigator's assistant, then legal assistant. And ultimately he said, you know, in this business, either you go to law school or you become a paralegal, but you should pick one or the other. And he encouraged me to go to law school. What was interesting is I pointed out to him that he should know, since I was dating his daughter.
And that's how he got the job.
Yes, yeah, actually is. But I barely got out of high school and didn't go to college. And he said, you know, I had a family when I went to night school as a lawyer. And other than your first job, nobody ever asks you where you went to law school. And he said I could go at night without going to college. And I went to University of West Los Angeles School of Law at night, a 4-year program. And I thank him for showing me the way. And along the way, I met some trial lawyers. And I was impressed that they fought for people's rights.
not just papers and not just sending letters, but they stood up, they went to court, they stared down the opposition and fought for people.
The notorious Mauro Fiore, he was on our podcast a few episodes ago, and he said something afterwards in the green room, and I don't know if it's true or not. He said there is a painting of Gary Dordick at that law school where he also was an alumnus of. And, you know, is that true, Gary?
Sadly, it is true.
Are you on top of a horse with your shirt off?
Men's room.
Men's room. Oh, it's a men's room painting.
You know, there's a lot to be said for the top law schools. Mr. Dolan will share with us the virtues of going to Georgetown.
Oh, we'll get to his pedigree.
Those that go there do tell you about it on a regular basis. For UWLA, I say it fast and it sounds like UCLA. But those of us that go to schools that are perhaps this is was an unaccredited, at least by the state bar or the American Bar Association, unaccredited law school. We go at night. Most of the student body is full time, hardworking, and it takes a lot to finish the curriculum and pass the bar. And there's a certain bond amongst all of us that go to these schools. And you have a lot of opposition and a lot of people that say you'll never make it, you'll never pass the bar. And so I was able to pass the bar my first time. I was able to succeed in a competitive field of law. And I think they like to have me as a reminder to all the students that if you work hard and you are motivated and push yourself, you can do anything you set your mind to.
And we hear that a lot. So do you think, so we have we have two opposite ends of the spectrum here today as far as, you know, education goes. You know, we have Gary, and Gary didn't go to college. A lot of people don't know that. I mean, it sounds crazy, the amount of success and wealth and following that you've had. People don't realize that about you. Is you got the experience through the experience and then went to law school.
Well, you know, I don't think I could ever succeed in many different aspects of law. I don't think they want me reading their contracts, and they don't want me doing trade secrets and all those kinds of different complex legal types of matters. But in the field of trial law, we deal with people. I always found my background, the way I came to be a lawyer, was in some ways an advantage when you're talking to jurors, when you're trying to communicate with people. They're a lot like me. They have backgrounds like me. And when you smell something that doesn't seem right and it doesn't feel right and it doesn't sound right to you, it doesn't sound right to them either. And I think that in many ways, the way I got to where I'm at has helped me communicate better with most jurors.
Oh, and then the other side of the pendulum is we have the education of Chris Dolan, which is impressive. So, Chris, why don't you share us your education background and how you think it prepared you to be where you are today?
So, my education goes way back before I went to school. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I do come from one of those stories where there was a lot of injustice. Mm-hmm. You could say I grew up Irish, which means a lot of things. It usually involves someone who's an alcoholic, someone who's a rageaholic, scarcity of resources, and a lot of violence. So I was the youngest of five children, and I had two older brothers that were much bigger. One of them actually was a karate instructor. He had a third-degree black belt. And there was a lot of, I'd have to say there's a lot of anger where I grew up. And unfortunately, when you're the youngest and the smallest, at least in my family, you tend to be the one who gets pounded on. So I had a great deal of difficulty. I had my nose fractured. I was thrown out of moving cars. I used to get punched in the head in the middle of the night. I slept with a knife under my pillow. And one night when my brother was asleep, and I can understand why women kill their husbands, and the abusive husbands in their sleep, I walked into his room with an aluminum baseball bat, and I was going to hit him over the head and kill him because I couldn't take
how old were you at
one
this
more
time?
Day. About 14, 15. Wow. But I couldn't do it because I knew it was wrong. And I think that's a fundamental, which is what's right and what's wrong. And just because somebody else was acting wrong didn't make it right for me. So it was great difficulty. And I got sidetracked with certain things that, you know, would numb the pain. And I was always an advocate for myself. And one thing that I never did was I never gave up. I can remember my brother saying to me one time, he'd say, just stay down. And I was like, I can't swear on this program. But I'm like, if I knew if I stayed down, my spirit would be crushed. So I got up until I got knocked out. And that's not a way that I think that people have to learn to be nimble or quick or wise. But for me, the tool I had was my tongue. And I knew how to use that. And I guess in retrospect, if I look back, I may have done as much injury on them in some ways as they did to me. So high school, I was anesthetized through most of it. And I remember teachers saying to me, you know, you're not living up to your potential. And I'd say, tell me something I don't know. And I started a landscaping business when I was about 16 because I need to achieve. Yeah,
I did too when I was that age.
Did you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I had to get economically independent from these people. And I had at one point when I was 18, I had 2 full-time crews on the road. And then I became a tree surgeon. I used to go up and top trees. And I remember being around we lived in a real swank town. We were not swank. But I used to mow lawns at these beautiful mansions. Yeah. And I'd be walking around. The guy would say, hey, can you help me turn on the water faucet? How did this guy get here? And on the back of every car was University of something. And so I knew that I had to get a ticket out of where I was. But my family didn't tell me I had to apply to college. So I didn't apply to college. And then everybody was going off to school. And I sort of thought you would just make that happen like you buy a 6-pack at a convenience store. So I went to a community college while I worked. I went to Norwalk Community College that was an abandoned factory, World War II factory building. And when I got there, I was like, okay, where are the co-eds? And it was, you know, old ladies stuffing their hair under their wig and 3-tooth folks. And I made a deal with Boston University that if I got a B average, that they would accept me. So I went from community college and I got into Boston University and they tried to renege on the deal, but I had it in writing. And when I got there, I went from being on the bottom 5th quintile. I mean, just to give you an idea, during my high school graduation, I turned 18 the same day. And that's when the drinking age was 18. So we were getting loaded on the stage. And the guy comes up and he pulls on my robe and he says, give me the beer. My attitude was, would you like another? And when I went to get my diploma, they had removed it. And there was a note that said, come to the principal's office for your diploma. So I went in and I said to the guy, do you really want me here for another year? And he gave me the diploma. But when I went to BU, you know, it started, everything for me has been, when you got a job, work your hardest. If you don't like the job, figure out how to do it more efficiently, and then you get caught up in the efficiency and not how much the job sucks. So my job was education, and I was paying for it. So I went from being the bottom 5th quintile of my class to having straight A's. Straight A's, and let's just say I had a few items that might be helping me stay awake at night. And so I went through university. I became president of the student body. And then I likewise did not read the program manual. And when I went to graduate, they said you need 4 semesters of a language. And I said, well, I took English. And they said no. So I went to Spain. I learned how to speak Spanish in over three months. And then I went to apply to law school, and I applied to these law schools, and I got this letter from everybody rejecting me. And one from BU came in and said, your transcript doesn't match up with your personal statement. Your personal statement says that you're living in Europe, but your transcript says you're failing out of 101 level classes. And it turned out that they'd cut and pasted somebody else's grades on my transcript during the time I was traveling through Europe after going to language school. So I called them up rather upset, and I said, you set me back a year in my career. And so they made a deal with me, and I went and I did an MBA over in London. I took a 2-year program, shrunk it down to a year. Did very well, applied to law school again. And I was waitlisted at Georgetown, which is where I wanted to go because my father went there, and we aren't that kind of family. I just wanted a way to connect with him. And then I got waitlisted, and then I got rejected. So I got on a plane, and I flew back to the United States, and I went down to Georgetown, and I knocked on the dean's door, and I said, hi, I'm Chris Dolan. He goes, you live in England, don't you? And I said, yeah, but I want you to see who I am, because the next time that I apply, I want you to know who I am. And I said,
how old were you at this point?
About 26. I took some time off. Kind of got everything straightened out at that point in time. And
hey, where did you learn this brashness? I mean, is this always who you
get the shit kicked out of you enough when you're younger and you don't take it? You just realize, in my way, it was like, okay, what's God's will for me? It's if I, everything short of lying, cheating, or stealing, like if I got rejected 2-3 times, I'd know it wasn't right. So I said, look, you want me to sit out here and answer your phone for a year? I'll do it. You want me to go downstairs and paint the basement of this building? I'll do it. I go, what do I need? I had straight A's in my master's degree. I said, I'm dyslexic. I don't fill out those tests. I said, what do I need to do to prove it to you? And he goes, well, this has been very interesting. I went home. This was before pagers, before cell phones. And I said, all right, I've done everything I can. The phone rang, and I picked it up, and it was his secretary. And she said, Mr. Kornblatt has said that he's found a place for you in the evening division, which was a four-year. And I just hooted and hollered, and I said, tell him I'm sending him a case of lobsters and a bottle of champagne. 10 minutes later, the phone rang. He's like, this is Mr. Kornblatt's secretary. I'm like, no takebacks. And she said, he's giving you a place in the day division.
Wow.
So I have a letter in my office, which is my rejection letter from Georgetown. And on the bottom, I wrote, it ain't over until the fat lady sings. And my mother was visiting, and she wrote, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. Go, man, go. So I believe, and that's part of this job. You don't give up. You know, when we're up against the giants of these law firms that have endless money and we're going against billion-dollar corporations, you know, it doesn't bother me because I'm not giving up.
Wow. So, I mean, a lot of people don't know that story. And, I mean, it's tenacity. And a lot of people, you see the fight in what everybody in this room does day to day. But it seems like it started young in you, Chris, and you, Gary, that these things, that they weren't given to you ever.
I've been given some failures, and I earned those too.
Yeah, so the next topic I want to kind of cover is all of us that are successful in any industry, especially what we do, is we find somebody that is our, like our master. We say, you know, you're our teacher, somebody that we look up to. Like, who is your role model? You know, Gary, you mentioned Michael Pughes from the beginning. It was funny. The first time I went out on my own, I rented an office from Mike Pughes, and I didn't even know the connection there at that point. But, you know, who are some of your, as you as a young lawyer, other than, you know, Don Collar, who you spoke about, like, who are your role models that you looked up to?
Well, Mike Pughes was the first trial lawyer I got to know well, and so I was able to follow his trials and know about the cases, and he never backed down. He never put his interest before his clients. He never thought about the money. He was passionate and motivated to fight no matter what the odds. I remember feeling so proud one day. He was suing R.J. Reynolds, the tobacco companies, for the cancer their cigarettes have caused for so many millions and millions of people. And of course, they're a multi-billion-dollar company. And when they interviewed the head of the tobacco company in the Wall Street Journal after Mike hit him for a couple billion dollars on a jury verdict, they said he was a bully and he was picking on them. I don't think there's a greater compliment for a lawyer than that. And so I watched him and respected him, and I hoped one day I could do what he did.
And how about for you, Chris?
So I didn't really have a mentor. I'm sort of a collage. So I'd see certain people. I mean, I didn't know which fork you use when you sat down at a table. And I dated this young woman whose father was loaded. And we went to these restaurants, and I'd wait for him to move, and then I'd move. And so in the law, I didn't. I had people that I worked for a firm for 2 years, and I learned what not to be, not necessarily what to do, but they were not good people. And they were very interested in keeping me down so they felt better about themselves. So in terms of mentors, when you thought about it, the one thing I can say is that within the Consumer Attorneys of California, I've seen people lead and change the law. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point in time, I don't know if it was Bruce Broyled or Brown Green, they had the, when you'd be president, you get the top floor of the Fairmont. It's this beautiful place. I remember walking in there one time and I go, you know what, I want to be here. And about 15 years later, I was there with my family. And so it was about watching the people who had respect and the people who had had success and the people who had made change. I guess in some ways I wish I had a mentor because I may not have made some of the mistakes that I made. But if I hadn't made those mistakes, I wouldn't be who I am.
So let's talk a little bit about that pride you talked about. You know, it took you 15 years to get to that milestone. But what are some of your proudest moments? Not with your family or familiar life, but I want to know your proudest moments as a lawyer, as a professional. What are the proudest things you could say? You know what? If I died tomorrow, it's not going to happen, you know, right? But what would they say about me? What were the most well-respected things that I did, the most pride that I had as a lawyer?
So one of the things that motivated me to become a lawyer was great lawyer movies in the past, like Philadelphia with
My
Tom
Cousin
Hanks.
Vinny.
But Tom Hanks in Philadelphia stood up for a guy who was a lawyer who had AIDS, and he died right about the time the verdict came in. But he stood for a fellow that he didn't like at first. But if I look back in terms of pride as a lawyer, the first case I ever tried was a dangerous condition of public property case. I was 2 years out of law school, and I took on the state of California. And I didn't know any better. And I put everything I had into that. And I'd never been to a trial. I'd never seen a trial. I had what we used to call a 5-in-1. It was like you'd have the government code, the evidence code. I had it stashed in the trash can. And when the judge would say something like, well, we're going to get into peremptory challenges, I said, Your Honor, can I take a break? I need to go to the bathroom. And I go and I look into the book. I'm like, I get to get rid of 6 people? Or yeah, this is awesome.
So like a trapper keeper full of your stuff.
Okay. And so that was an 8-week trial. And at the end of it, I decimated this cop, which was the key point. And we won a $2.49 million verdict. And that
wow,
was back
two,
in
two
1995.
Wow.
And the judge looked at me and he said, well, I said, my court reporter tells me this is your first trial. I said, yes, sir, Your Honor. He goes, well, you must have sat at somebody's right hand for a long time. I sort of sound like Gary. I said, no, Your Honor, I've never even been to small claims court. And he goes, well, how'd you do this? I said, well, I watch a lot of lawyer movies and I have an overactive imagination. So I was very proud of that, but I'd have to say one of the proudest things is when I kept Jahi McMath from being killed.
Wow, yeah, I remember that in the newspapers.
It was a brutal battle.
Yeah.
There was no law on point. We made law. I mean, we made law about the rights of people declared brain dead. And I kept a woman who was going to be disconnected. The state court had a 4 o'clock deadline. And at 3:58 after a federal court filing, we got an extension. And her mother was sitting on death row. And when I called her and heard her cry, and she said, you saved my daughter. Now, that case cost me $250,000 when I was done. But it was well worth it because, you know, why did I get that phone call? And I made that lady a promise, and I kept it. And so I was very proud of that. Uber,
yeah.
I mean, I did work on Uber after the first wrongful death case, went to the legislature, fought like a dog, and got $1 million worth of insurance coverage for everybody. So all you listeners out there who made money off of Uber or Lyft, you owe me at least 10% because you wouldn't have had any insurance. But that's the kind of thing. It's legacy work that I'm doing now.
Yeah. So Gary, for you, what are your proudest moments as a professional?
You know, I just look at the individuals I've represented. And, of course, when we succeed for, I think Chris had a spill.
Yeah, I'm only drinking Diet Coke. Kombucha.
When we succeed, there is no feeling like watching your client when a jury returns a verdict in their favor and knowing that you were you fought for them to improve their lives. You fought for justice for them. But a few that stand out in my mind, I represented a young girl who became a quadriplegic at 11 years old. And we sued the city of Los Angeles for a defective road condition. And she was the sweetest child. She had so much courage and had suffered through so much. Her sister was also killed in the same accident crossing the street. And we fought as hard as we could, and the case was thrown out on summary judgment. And it's one of those rare cases where I managed to lose it essentially twice on summary judgment. And it was devastating to feel that I failed and I let her down. And that her life without medical care, without resources and left to public service is going to be unimaginably horrible. And also people that don't represent catastrophically injured people don't understand that
how long they live and the quality of life they have is directly dependent on their access to medical care. The better medical care they have, the longer they will live, and there's no way around it, and the better the quality of their life. And when I lost it on summary judgment, it was devastating. And then a year or so later, we reversed that on a 2-1 decision, and they reinstated the case to trial, and we settled it with the city for $15 million and set up annuities where she could leave a home that she had to be placed in and move with her family and have 24-hour nursing care. And just to be a part of that and to look in her eyes and visit her at home and see the house that they bought for her, a van to transport her so she didn't just sit around and stare at a TV all day, that feeling you get knowing that you were responsible for bringing that result, there's no greater feeling in the world. It gives you such pride in what we do as trial lawyers, and to be a part of it was an amazing thing for me to do.
So I want to hear about, you went, that case probably took a while because it went through appeal, but what is the longest amount of time that you've had a case? And it comes to my mind, I seem to recall you had a case in San Bernardino that just went forever.
Yeah. When people call me with very important causes that are going to take years and years of work and potentially the expenditure of tremendous amount of money, and they're unlikely to actually produce fees, I refer all of them to Chris Dolan.
That's a second P, right?
We have his
yeah,
number.
Yeah, Gary P'd on it first, and then he sent it to me.
Yeah, we have it.
And he took a referral fee, too.
No.
Nerve.
Yeah.
That guy.
Gary doesn't charge referral fee on his crappy cases.
As soon as I hear that layout, I just immediately think that Chris is the man for this job. Somewhere along the line, I was told of a case against the prison system where a guard was sexually molesting young males. They were held as youth offenders, but they were able to keep them as adults from the years 18 until 25. And there was a prison of young men, 18 to 25 years old, the hardest offenders, murder, serious violent crime. They were incarcerated 23 hours a day and allowed out of their cell 1 hour a day. And this guard would molest them and say things to them like, "Who's going to believe you? You're a felon and I'm a correction officer." And he got away with it for years. And I was brought into the case. The litigation between trips to the courts of appeals lasted over 10 years.
Wow.
The trial lasted over 4 months. And we successfully prevailed for all of the inmates that we were able to represent. Some had statute problems, but we went to trial on 4 of them. We won on all 4 and achieved a significant verdict on their behalf. And it was it's a very difficult thing to spend 4 months in trial. Everything stops. And the problem is we have a lot of people relying on us to represent them in court. And when you spend 4 months in trial on one case, everything gets put on the back burner, and it's not necessarily fair to the other clients, but the cause was so important. And after 10 years, the trial is what, it's the culmination of a lot of hard work from a lot of people, but it was a great moment when the jury returned a verdict.
So I'm going to, as trial lawyers, what Gary talked about, you know, we're out of our homes, away from our family for extended periods of time sometimes, you know, and both of you gentlemen have had wide success of having great spouses, great family, kids around you, you know, and so I want to ask you, Chris, how are you able to, you know, doing what you do to promote change, to do the policy, the work you do with the lobbying groups to make everybody, all consumers' lives better and trying cases, how are you able to be away from home so much, trying cases, making the world a better place, and still have that strong family life? How do you find that balance?
So I'll use a real-time example right now. There's a case I'm doing, doesn't have a lot of money in it. It was a hoverboard case where it burst into flames. Woman had to pick it up, burned her hands trying to get it out of her house that partially burned down. Lithium-ion batteries. So hoverboards were blowing up, and, well, they're being, in two ways. They're being sold like crazy, and they were blowing up. So right now I've got a case against Amazon. And Amazon has never been held liable for strict product liability in the chain of distribution. In every state that they've ever had the issue come up, they've won it. So I've taken on Amazon, and it's actually, I think the case is down here in L.A., and we've done tons of research. And I went up, and I had to spend time up in Seattle to depose their person most knowledgeable on product safety. And I was away for a few days, and, you know, it was my son had a school function that was going on. And I have a great wife. Mm-hmm. She watched me try three cases 1 year that she wasn't working after the dot-com bust. And she said to me, she goes, I will never begrudge you for the time that you spend working for these people. Because she goes, I can just see what their lives would be like without you. So what I can also say is that Gary actually has been a great mentor as it relates to families and children. And he still, he talks to me about things and don't worry about this and it's going to be okay. And he said that one of the best things he said to me is, you know, be involved in your kids' lives. Know who their friends are, know what they're doing, and trust them that if you've raised them right, they're going to make the right decisions. But Gary and I spend a lot of time together, and my kids are well-behaved, and Gary hates kids. But he'll let he lets my kids come around. They call him Uncle Gary. They're with me now. So whenever possible, where I go, they go. And like I said, I think my wife has been very generous, and she knows what's in my heart and what's in my mind, and she's proud of what I do. And I think that that helps quite a bit, to do things that are esteemable and to have people who love you in your life who get that this is really important.
Yeah, and Gary, I think, out of your five kids, three of them are lawyers. Well, one's in her last year, but I mean, that's got to speak something. You got to be proud about that. I mean, they're following your footsteps.
Yeah, nothing would make me happier, or would have made me happier, than having my children go into law. But it's something that I wanted so bad that you have to be careful how much you push for it. Because, as I told you, way back in another life, I taught martial arts. It was the biggest part of my life for 10 years, 20 years. I really thought that was how I'd spend my entire life, which is kind of strange. But at the time, that's how I saw it. So when I had kids, I put them all into martial arts. I pushed them into martial arts. I pushed hard, and I saw how it helped me change my life, how it gave me discipline and some coordination and different things.
Splits, you know.
Yeah, and in return, all of them rebelled. None of them had any interest in it and were very unhappy with the amount of pressure I put on them. And I realized that they have to figure out what they want to do on their own. But I think that my kids growing up in a house where we talked law at the table, my friends came over, mostly all trial lawyers. We talked about the fights. We talked about the victories. We talked about our successes. And they saw it and they lived it. And I feel such pride that out of my five children, two are lawyers now, one right here at the Simon Law Firm.
Yeah.
And
this guy stole him from me. He was a law clerk for me. But between Rally, myself, and Simon, we're all fighting over Dylan.
Yeah, that's true. My son Dylan is just finished his first year here. And I know he couldn't be happier working with you. My daughter, Michelle, is doing family law. My daughter, Taylor, is now going into her final semester at Loyola Law School. And then the other two said, sorry, Dad, we don't want to do law. But in answer to your question to Chris, it's not easy on our families what we do, the time we work and the time we spend from home. But I think they know how important it is, and they have to be involved in what we do. They celebrate our wins, and they help us when we lose. And it's really a family. When you're involved in law, it's the whole family that's involved. And they understand, like Chris says, I don't want to be in a hotel in Modesto for 3 weeks. I don't want to be away from home. I like to sleep in my own bed, and I like to be home. But it's what we do. It's the sacrifices we make as trial lawyers. And my wife, Nava, is very supportive of what I do and when I have to be away. And, you know, it's just, it's a hard part of being a trial lawyer, but the rewards are so great that we do what we have to do when we have to do it.
So you know, let me ask you a little bit about...
let me just tell you something. You know, there's the WTLA, Western Trial Lawyers Association. Well, before that, it was the Wives of Trial Lawyers Association. It's a 12-step program for understanding your trial lawyer. But, you know, I think a lot of us, we get together. Yeah. Gary said trial lawyers tend to hang out with trial lawyers because we get each other. And if Gary's in trial, you know, I don't hear from him. Gary gets pissed at me if I don't text him back, but I just shut my brain down. My wife understands it. I know women whose husbands understand it, and they have this, I wouldn't call it an acceptance. They have a pride in what we do.
Yeah. I think it's important for all trial lawyers that, I mean, you have to find that soulmate, that spouse that understands, you know, that about us and us about them is what is important to them. And we come together whenever, you know, we have to. But I got to ask you this. So we talked a little bit about sharing losses as a family, the highs and the lows. So Gary, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, as a trial lawyer, if you're not going to get the ring to lose, you're not in the ring. So are there any losses that stick out to you or that have inspired you, or how do you deal with them? Or have you never lost?
I always love when I get a defense lawyer who suggests he's never lost a trial. And I figure it's one of two things. Either he's not trying cases, or he's settling every case that gets near trial. But losing is part of being a trial lawyer. This idea that trial lawyers never lose is a total fiction, because if you try hard cases, which we do, and you try them against good lawyers, which is what we have against us, and the stakes are large, and you do it long enough, no lawyer is going to win every case every time. And there's nothing worse than the feeling of losing, nothing worse than feeling you let the client down. People say, well, I had a bad judge, I had a bad jurisdiction, I had a bad jury, my expert didn't do well, I got a bad ruling. But at the end of the day, it's you. You lost the case. You, as the trial lawyer, are in control, and you're responsible for the win, and you're responsible for the loss. And there's no way around it. There's no sugarcoating it. There's no way to feel better. Drinking doesn't help, and nothing will make you feel better. The only thing I can say about it is you learn a lot more from your losses than you do your wins. When you lose, you think about everything that was said and everything you should have done and could have done, and it goes over in your mind over and over, and it'll keep you from sleeping, and you'll remember. A year later, 5 years later, and 10 years later, you'll remember every single loss, and you learn from it, and you become a better lawyer for it. And that's part of what motivates us as much as we are. We work, most of us, 7 days a week. The harder part for us trial lawyers is learning how to relax. I don't like vacations. I have trouble relaxing. I'm going on vacation.
We're trying to work on that. We've been talking to your wife. We're working on
it. Yeah, I'm going on vacation tomorrow for 4 days. We're going to go to Mexico, and I've already loaded all of the next trial I have coming up in my briefcase. I put all the magazines I need to read, the legal journals. And so I'm working on it. I'm working on learning to relax. But that fear of loss and the significance of those losses is what keeps us working late at night and early in the morning and working as hard as we do. So there's no way around it, but you learn from them and you do everything in your power not to have it happen.
So Chris, I could still see those jurors that voted against me in every trial that they did. And I wonder, is that just me, or do you have that too? Do you still remember those losses and those people that just didn't believe in what you were talking about?
So I think that they call it a trial for a reason rather than they don't call it a winner. It's not like I'm going to a winner. I'm going to a trial. In the way that I look at it and the way that I talk to the lawyers when they second chair with me or if they're going to trial on their own, I'll say, listen, my job is to put on the best case possible. And so at the end of a trial, I always look at my client and I say, do you feel that you got your story told? Do you feel that you got the best chance? And I look at my own actions and I say, well, did I watch a football game instead of getting prepared for that next day? And if I look back and I see that I've done everything I could, and they look at me and they said, yes, I thank you. So I'm responsible for the input. I'm not responsible for the output. 12 people are responsible for that output. And I mean, I have a kind of a, I have a spiritual focus to trying law. How am I to know what would happen if that person got $2 million? Would they go out and buy an ounce of cocaine and kill themselves? Would they buy a really fast sports car and kill somebody else? So I think that, you know, I do my best and I leave it up to the jury and I leave it up to God to figure out what's right to these people and what should be. And so, yeah, I want to win. I want my ego to reflect that everything I've done was worth it. But I think you have to look at what makes it worth it. I've had cases where I lost a dangerous condition of public property case. There's a stop sign there now. Mm-hmm. You want to know why? Because if somebody else gets hurt there and they went through this whole trial and I've got all these depositions, they're hosed. I lost it because there were no prior accidents. Mm-hmm. But this next person won't lose it for that reason. And so, I did another case. I did a case against the BART, the Bay Area Rapid Transit. My client got a beat down. And there were cameras all over, but they didn't keep the video. Hmm. We went to trial. I had an all-white jury. I had an African-American client, and I had a racist outcome, pretty damn sure. Mm. But what happened when we left is they put so much media attention on this that they changed their policy, and they keep video whenever there's an interaction now. The San Francisco Sheriff's Department has a policy about transgender women who wear weaves because they rip the hair out of my client's head when they tore her weave off of. I lost that client. You know, and some of these things, a lot of times they've said to a judge, I said, I lost that case. And they said, no, your client lost that case. Wow. I tried this case, and she's a really outstanding person, trans woman. And we were trying it over Christmas. And on New Year's Eve, she came in dressed like Diana Ross in a miniskirt. And she's going to have a benefit that night, right? And she'd had a history of cocaine problems and never had a problem with the jail before. And the defense lawyer goes, you know, you had a cocaine problem. She goes, I don't smoke rocks. I wear rocks. And she waved the rings on her fingers. My associate goes, what do you do? I said, get some popcorn. This ship is going down.
Oh, God. You know, Chris, I got a whole bunch of cases downstairs for you that you might be interested in. I have to listen to those.
But I've Rumpelstiltskin's a lot of stuff. I've turned some real crap into gold.
And that's because you believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of want to cover, we're going to go off topic a little bit here because we do have the Lotte Gras coming up, which you guys are all speakers of. And I kind of want to hear, because we have Collar Me Bad, Rob Bass, Young MC, Tone Loc, one of Gary's favorites. We've had this discussion. Who are your top, give me your top three, Chris Dolan, top three famous, your favorite artists that if they're on the radio, you're not turning it off. Who are your top three favorite?
So, you know, I was thinking about this. One of them is Tupac.
Nice.
Because Tupac told it like it was. Mm-hmm. Right now, Tim McGraw. Hmm. And there's a song that he did that my sister played.
Love Faith Hill, by the way.
Yeah. Hmm. Sister did my brother's funeral. She played it. And it, you know, what is it to be humble and kind? And that's something I'm trying to work on because I've been a fighter for all my life and I'm trying to work on. I mean, I got the humility part down, but when somebody pisses me off on the other side, now I say, listen, let's not do this. You know, I don't want to get into this with you. So, you know, could you please just focus on your...
You might only have two P's after this.
Right.
And then you might be a PP.
And I say the second time, I say, listen, I got to tell you, it's unnatural for me to have done this once. Mm-hmm. But the second time, and I think that, you know, having done this for 25 years, I realize that I don't have to tell other lawyers how stupid they are. The jury will do that eventually. Mm-hmm. And then there's one song that's by Eminem, and it's the one in the movie where he's about to go do that big battle rap.
Yeah.
And he says something like, failure is not a blank option. Mm-hmm. And that's what I say to myself.
You got one chance.
Yeah, you only get one chance. That's what I think when I walk into that courtroom. I hear that music in my head, and it gets me hyped up. And it's because that is my chance. And failure is not an option.
So we used to, before sports games in high school, we used to listen to a lot of Rage Against the Machine in our car before we got in there. You know, same. We didn't have Eminem yet, but, you know, it was a similar message. So, Gary, we got our top three from Chris. So I want to hear your top three favorite artists. It could be a duo. It could be a boy band. Whatever you got.
God, I hope it's not a boy band. You know, it's not my favorite artist, but when you talk about motivating songs, I love On My Way to Trial. to play Tom Petty's "I Won't Back Down."
Nice.
That line where they, you can put me up to the gates of hell and I won't back down. And when you get nervous and you start thinking or doubting yourself on the way to trial, especially that first morning before it starts and all the what ifs and what might go wrong in your mind, that song about not backing down, I love to hear it. But all time number one, if I had only one artist to pick and I were on an island, there's no question, and I'm a little disappointed in Chris, it would be Bob Seger.
Nice. Just
so many great songs. And if I go more recent, my current favorite is Chris Stapleton. Just in every album he's done, I think it's four now, are just amazing. And if I pretend to have some culture, it would be Andrea Bocelli.
Oh, nice.
Who's coming up in concert at the Hollywood Bowl. But those three, I'd say if there's only three, I'll take those three.
So we're going to talk about some advice for our young lawyers. What are some common mistakes that you guys see out there in the courtroom or even before the courtroom that you said, look, if I had some pieces of advice for you guys and gals, just don't do this. Gary, what are some of those?
You know, I think that perhaps it could be misinterpreted, but I don't like new lawyers, young lawyers, lawyers without a lot of experience going out and trying a brain damage case or a death case or a catastrophic injury case. I see today too many lawyers without the necessary experience thinking about themselves, thinking about, I'm going to make a fee. This is a good case for my business of law. And they're not thinking about the client. And it's a mistake. People trust us with the most important things in their life, like I indicated, perhaps things that will dictate how long they live if they get the necessary surgery or care they need. And then you have young lawyers that think, oh, I attended a seminar and now I'm going to go represent a brain injured person. And it's not fair to the client. The client doesn't know that they don't have the experience. And these there are young lawyers that just don't know what they don't know. And they should handle smaller cases and joint venture with more experienced lawyers to learn how to do it right. This is not a game. This is not something just about money. It's real people's lives that they trust us with. And I think some young lawyers today get too much into the business of law and think too much about the money they might make or the money they might give up. And they don't think about their clients enough. And it's something that can lead to real problems. And the other thing I would say is that for young lawyers, when I say they don't know what they don't know, it's very difficult to teach things like instincts. It's difficult to teach timing. Even if you know what to say or you have a transcript, you know, I give away a lot of transcripts for my trials. I give my cross-examination to lawyers. I give my closing arguments to young lawyers. And I like for them to take what they can and to read it and to use it as best they can. But it takes time to do it effectively. It takes time to learn how to read a jury. It takes time to get a feel of what's going on in a courtroom and how to do your cross-examination. And when do you ask another question and when do you sit down? When do you go further with a juror or when do you stop the voir dire? Who do you exclude on your jury panel and who do you accept as a member? I've been doing it now. I'm coming into my 32nd year. And I still learn something every trial, and I learn something every day. And it took me a long time to get the experience I have. And I don't fault lawyers for wanting to try as many cases as they can, but they can't lose track that people's lives are in our hands, and you need to be respectful of that, the importance of that.
And I think that's it's an important point, because even when I was a young lawyer, I mean, I partnered up with Gary when I idolized him. But it's important to give your client's the best shot. It's not about you. It's about what's the best result for them. I think we miss that sometimes. So Chris, how about you? What are some mistakes that you see some young lawyers, trial lawyers, or just in general make that could be corrected?
Okay. Check your fly before you stand up in front of the jury. That's one of them, because otherwise they aren't going to hear a damn word you say. You don't have to prove every point. You don't have to get everything that you ever got in a deposition in front of a jury. You need to know what to pick as to what's important, because if you keep asking questions on peripheral items, you lose the jury's focus on the important things. So I'll have clients say to me, why didn't you ask this question? I'll say, look, here's the target. Here's the bullseye. That's out here. Mm-hmm. So people need to be careful not to waste the juror's time or attention. And the second thing I can say is be yourself. I think you'll find a lot of really good trial lawyers have self-deprecating humor. You get up in front of the jury, you be real, you make mistakes, you go, I made a mistake. One time I had my microphone on because I use a lapel mic. And I was talking to a juror and I said, okay, juror, no, excuse me, sir. And she had a very much of a Mao haircut. She goes, I'm not sir, I'm man. I go, I'm sorry about that. I go, I'm never going to stand a chance now with you, am I? And the jury started laughing. And then we went over for cause and I hadn't turned the microphone off.
Oh, no.
And I said to the judge, I said, judge, I'm never going to fair shot with her. I called her a man. I said, she looked like, and they all start laughing over there. And my head pops up and they go, your microphone's on. And the judge excused her and then said to me, she goes, I thought the same thing.
Hopefully you had a preemptory challenge left just in case the judge didn't excuse that juror.
So could we all, what is the hardest part? If you had to pick the hardest part of trial, we don't have to have a discussion on it, but like, what is the hardest thing, the experience-driven thing to learn about the trial?
So it's sitting there when things are going bad mm-hmm. and not looking like things are going bad.
Just that.
You know, cool you sit vibe. There and if something's going downhill, you kind of meander yourself around because they're looking to see what your reaction mm-hmm. is. And if your reaction is to drop a crab cake in your pants, they're going to know it.
Gary?
Chris is from the Maine area, so that expression to drop a crab cake in your pants may not...
I went to George Washington, D.C. I get that reference, yeah, right? We get that.
I think just the two of you do. I would say that one of the hardest things for lawyers to do is to shut up. Mm-hmm. Some of them, they're... Almost everything is too long, the opening, the closing, the cross. And you don't have to ask one too many questions too many times to realize, yeah, less was more. So I think for lawyers who like to talk, not talking is so important. I'll stop there.
Yeah, so I'll stop there with that question. So we're going to do a little bit more of a, it's a little off topic, but I want to know, what would your wives say was the most ridiculous thing that you've ever purchased?
This watch? it happened to have been after a very big trial, a very big win, and my daughter looks at me and she goes, Daddy, do you think you're a rapper? And my wife looked at me and said, seriously? She said, do you know how many shoes that is worth? And then I can't say anything.
So, Gary, how about you? Most ridiculous thing you think that Nava's ever said that you bought?
Well, there's a lot of things I bought my wife finds ridiculous, but certainly the biggest or most significant, and in my defense, I know I'll come off like half an ass for or a full ass for even buying it, but the idea for me is as you achieve some success and there's something that might be important to you that others may not appreciate. For me, some people buy artwork. A lot of people I know have invested in art or invested in crazy cars and things like that. And for me, I'm a little bit off to begin with. I bought a dinosaur, and I have a dinosaur in my living room, a real dinosaur. It was brought in the country at a time when it was allowed to take them out of Budapest. I bought it at auction, and it's probably the most exciting thing people ever see when they come to my house. And I think it's the coolest thing, and it probably costs the same as certain artwork that people hang on their wall. But when people come to my house, it's like, yes, I have a dinosaur.
Okay, I thought you were going to say it was the lowrider you purchased.
Well, my wife hated that more, yeah. Yes, but I did buy that also.
So I think what most people would say about either of you gentlemen is you're the most generous people, not only with your wealth and your donations to the community, but also your time. So why do you, the both of you, you give a large amount of your time to these even doing this podcast, to doing conferences, to helping young lawyers. So Chris, why do you do that? I mean, you could be introvert, you could just do your own thing, but why do you do that?
Because justice does not thrive in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And without people who are working with others to get the proper justice for their clients, it withers and dies. And without people going to the state capitol and making laws, like right now I'm working on these little scooters, these scoots and skips, people are going to get crushed by these things. So right now I'm working on a bill to deal with those and to require them to have insurance. And why do I do that? Because technology is evolving, the world is evolving, and if we sit back and we just think about, okay, I'm going to go for this next verdict, then this withers and dies. And if it wasn't for people before me who went out and did this and made law and who protected the law, I wouldn't be here today. And if we don't do it now, we've been working on autonomous vehicles, right? If we don't work on that and make sure that the consumers are protected, that that information in that car is available to the person who's in the accident and isn't owned by the company, then justice becomes extinct.
Like Gary's dinosaur.
Yeah.
So, Gary, how about you?
What was the question?
Well, Chris, what was the question?
He's just faking his brain injury seminar. So the question was, why do you spend this time and money and...
Sorry, I fell asleep. when I was a young lawyer, people were very kind to help me. I knew nothing, and they were very helpful to me. And the way I see things is I don't feel I'm competing with the others that do what I do. I feel like we're in a common fight representing people that have been catastrophically injured or killed, and we're fighting insurance companies, generally, or large corporations that have billions of dollars and don't want to pay what's due. They don't want to be held responsible. And if I can help somebody properly represent their client to do better for their clients, then I think I'm obligated to do it, and I take pleasure in doing it. We need to help each other, and the better everyone else does, I think the better it is for society and the better it is for our communities that people are held accountable when they do something wrong. There's nothing worse than seeing an incompetent lawyer. There's nothing worse than seeing lawyers do their job badly. So I do my part to help anyone who asks whenever I can to be better at what they do, what we do.
So, but I'm going to tell you something that I was thinking of when Gary was talking. It was about ice cream. I was thinking about, no.
Is this also the open fly? Is this where this is going?
So, there was a case. These guys came into my office after 9/11. It was about 6 months after 9/11. Two Lebanese guys. They were being mercilessly harassed at work. Towelheads, sand jockeys, sand niggers, camel riders, just brutally harassed. And nobody would in any way help them. They went to the NAACP, the Anti-Defamation League. Everybody said, no, you can't do that in this climate. Nobody's going to give you a fair shake, right? And I looked at it and I said, this is wrong. And that's where a lot of times it starts out. Now, 5 years later, when we sat in court, I was able to look at this jury and say, there are people dying in the Middle East to bring democracy and justice. And I said, what kind of America do you want to be? And there was a $61 million verdict. And I got to tell you, every corporation in the United States, these defense firms, they had seminars that had to deal with Middle Eastern harassment. And so it's like, you know, we got to put a stop to this. And the only way to do it is to just put your hand up and say, not on my watch.
Wow. So not on you're talking about your blinged out watch?
No, that was back when I was wearing a time. I don't wear this to court, by the way. I do what Gary does. I've got my shock watch, the plastic one, and I wear that. Or actually, I wear an Apple Watch now because I'm up in San Francisco.
Oh, you're so high tech, so high tech.
I would say that's what Gary does. Just for the record here, I actually wear a very nice watch, but it's simple.
The Mickey Mouse one?
Ooh.
No. But
the Da Vinci Code? Or what are we doing? So I want to – we got just a few more minutes here, and we're going to end this, and I want to know, our listeners want to know, what are some superstitions you guys have? Do you have any trial superstitions that you guys roll in with or things that you think about?
Well, since I guess we're nearing the end of time and of our time. We didn't get to one question that I wanted to get to, so I might hijack your question.
Hijack away. This is Con Air, but for lawyers.
I'll do it quick. In terms of superstitions, I don't believe in them, and they're probably not any good. I mean, not changing your socks for a whole trial or not changing your underwear, I don't think serves anybody a good purpose. And
you're wrong on that.
The way I look at it is I don't believe in luck, good or bad. I don't believe in superstitions. I believe in hard work and making things happen. But the question that I thought we might get to was our greatest trial moments. Mm-hmm. And I'll just share quickly. I had two, but if time is short, I'll narrow it to one. I was in a road design trial against Simi Valley against the Simi Valley School District. And the issue was whether a crosswalk was dangerous leading to the school. And that was another multi-year battle. It went to this appellate court three times and Supreme Court, I think, three times. It's published law, Joyce versus Simi Valley. But what was hotly fought was the defense wanted a scene viewing, and we fought about it, and they wanted the jury to go to the scene. And I thought, there's just a lot of problems, and I was against it. We argued a half a day. The judge rules, no, the jury gets to go there, even though it had been repaved. They get to see the crosswalk. And the judge, feeling somewhat uncomfortable in the real world, of course, he walks down the street as we ride in the bus there wearing his robe. The sheriff comes with the badge and the gun, and it was kind of fun, actually, sitting on a bus with a jury and driving to a scene, and we get out. And my point was the crosswalk on a T-intersection was dangerous because cars won't stop, and that's where my client was brain injured. And the judge gathers up the jury wearing his robe, and we cross through the crosswalk, and a car almost killed the judge. A car ran through the intersection, almost taking all of us out, of course, making my point how dangerous the intersection was. And it was so unbelievable the way it came together, and people said to me, you had somebody drive through the intersection, didn't you? And to this day, I thought, God, if I were that smart. But it was an amazing thing to see that car zip through the intersection with a judge in his robe and a bailiff in his gun and the entire jury there. So it was one of my favorite moments in trial.
How long ago was that, Gary?
That trial was probably at least 15 years ago. Wow. And then, of course, I had that one experience in trial that I gave you the transcript on, where I was cross-examining in Ventura billing expert who suggested all of the billing from my expert my doctor's was fraudulent. Hundreds of thousands of dollars in billing, she suggested, was all outrageous and fraudulent. And on cross-examination, her testimony was somewhat powerful the way she went through it with the jury, and they were all writing it down. And on cross-examination, I stood up, and it's just one of those things that you couldn't write, but I said, excuse me, does this courtroom look familiar to you? She said, well, no. I said, this department, department whatever it was, 39 Ventura Superior Court, look familiar at all? Like you've been here? She's confused, and the jury's confused, and the judge is confused. And I say, well, isn't it true that you were found liable by a judge for fraud in this very exact courtroom? And I go charging at her with a copy of the judgment, finding that her and her husband's business defrauded all these people out of money. And it was just the way, the power of the question and the way it hung in the air and the way she took the bait and then the judgment and the screaming defense lawyer. And the judge is like, no, we want to see it. And it was a turning point that led to a
$150 million verdict.
No, I only got $126 million that time.
So, Chris, how about for you? Well, we went to superstitions, but you can con air me all you like.
So, I have certain things that I think of, and they're not superstitions. They're just things that I do. I had one in the past, which is I used to get these really bushy eyebrows, and I wouldn't have anybody cut them. And then I realized
that's like a recluse thing
that had nothing to do with it. But I do certain things before I go in, and again, people wouldn't get that I'm actually a person who tries to figure out what God wants. Mm-hmm. But I say, give me the wisdom, the courage, and strength, and the knowledge of your will, and the power to carry it out.
It's funny. I almost always pray for wisdom and courage, not only for me, but for the jury. That's funny you say that.
One of the other things that I do is when I walk in, I take a deep breath and I look at that jury and I say, give me the people. Hmm. And the reason is because at that point, everything those people are good at has stopped. And I think to myself, you're in my house now.
Wow. Well, yeah. Should we cue some Flo Rida?
You talk of superstition, and I'm so quick to dismiss them because of my own beliefs. But an interesting similar thought, though, is all of us as trial lawyers have certain things we try to do every trial. It's not a superstition, but for example, and I know you follow in my footsteps, I think, in large part, during trial, I try not to eat a lot. Mm-hmm. I like lean and mean. I generally don't eat breakfast. I don't overeat at night. I don't drink alcohol during my trials. I don't go out and celebrate. I don't socialize really during trial. I look at it like it's war, and I want to be in shape for it. I want to be ready for it. I want to have the mindset. I sleep it. I breathe it. When I'm in the shower, I'm thinking of arguments. I try to work out. If I can, I try to go for a run every morning when I'm in trial, and that's where I think of some of the best cross-examination is on these runs or walks. And so I do the same things every trial. I wear essentially the same suit, same ties. It's not a superstition, but I think it's what serves me best. It works for me, and I think it works best for my clients.
Wow. I try not to break a leg. I was trying a case on my way to court. I tripped because I have a bad leg. You talked about the upcoming seminar. I'm going to be speaking on Crips because I have it, and I have a drop foot. And my co-counsel said, hey, judge is taking the bench. You need to get over here. So I was hurrying over, and my drop foot caught a piece of the road, and I put my left leg out, and I broke my ankle. And so my assistant goes, are you all right? And I said, no, I broke my ankle. He goes, what do you want to do? I said, I got to get over there to the courthouse. And I walked in, and she was sitting there, and she was nervous, and she's like, is everything good? Everything good? And I go, well, I've been up all night. PowerPoint's not quite finished. I broke my ankle on the way over here and took two Vicodin, and I said, who knows what's going to happen? But you know what I did? I had the trust. And that's the thing that you get after a certain amount of time is you trust your instinct, and you trust that this will get done, and you don't let the panic overcome you. Is you ride the wave. I tell people that I'm an intellectual surfer because stuff breaks right, it breaks left. You don't know what's going to happen, what kind of day the judge is going to happen, and you just have to hang that wave and have faith you're going to get to the shore.
Just roll with it.
You know, now that we're completely hijacking your show, I'm going to say one more thing that I think is important for listeners, and if it makes the final cut, I would like that.
Cue the cutting board now.
Yeah. I've lectured about this many times, and I've been very vocal about it. But as most people know, 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. And at the time, you know, I was given a 7-year life expectancy. And then now it's just past 10 years. They upped it to a 10-year life expectancy. And thankfully, with new technology and new medicine, they say we don't even know anymore. There's been there's been great advances in cancer treatment in general and with my type of lymphoma. But I've told this to other lawyers, and I think it's very important. After a diagnosis like that, in a strange way, my quality of life went up. I learned not to sweat the small things, and I learned the importance of family and friends. I previously, particularly as a young trial lawyer, I sacrificed a lot for my cases and my clients. I missed a lot of family time. I missed a lot of vacations. I missed a lot of things that I shouldn't have missed because I liked working and I wanted to work, and I made perhaps bad choices. And I learned with the diagnosis, I don't know how long I'm going to live. I don't think any of us can control how long we're going to live, but I learned that you have to live each day as best you can. And you have to get your priorities together, and you have to realize how important it is to have good friends and to make meaningful friendships. And if my kids want me to spend time with them, I'm going to do it. And if they want to go to lunch or dinner, I'm going to make sure I do it. And I'm going to make sure I make time to do a vacation or spend it with my family because it's important. It doesn't take away from the bigger picture of what we do as trial lawyers, but I learned that that you have to have that balance and you have to make good decisions. And we work so hard at law that sometimes lawyers don't work hard enough at the rest of life. And being many great trial lawyers we know are terrible family people and or even terrible human beings, some of them. Not many, but it happens. And the reality is we have to make the effort to have those relationships and spend time with our families. And so for me, I think I've, since my diagnosis, my quality of life has gone way up. And I'm so thankful for the time I can spend with my kids and with my friends. And so I make that a priority. And what I say to folks is, don't wait to get bad news to make better decisions and to put in the proper context that all you have control over is how well you live your life now. And make sure you spend that time with your family and make sure you spend the time with your friends, because at the end of the day, I think it's critical that we're good at what we do, representing our clients, and it's also critical that we spend the time with the people we care about.
So if you tuned out of our podcast a little early today, you're a jerk because you missed that. But I wanted to tell both you gentlemen the story of how I first knew or met you. So Gary ties into that. The first time I knew of you is I opened up the Advocate magazine and you were running out. It was a cartoon ad of you running out of a hospital with your hospital gown on, with your Robin Hood tattooed. I got to find it for our listeners, and we got to post this on YouTube because it's fantastic. And it says, I'm in remission, I'm ready, running out of the hospital.
Actually, it was better than that. It was a picture of me pulling the IV,
the IV thing.
Line, running through the hospital with the hospital gown in the back, showing my little behind sticking out.
Right?
Yeah. And it was chasing somebody in a wheelchair with a cast saying, was it an accident?
Well, that was when I first knew Gary Dorn. I said, I got to meet this guy. So Chris Dolan, the first time I ever met you, you probably don't remember this. This was a decade ago where I was in we were in Sacramento for Justice Day, and I was at the Women's Caucus, and Eric Brown brought me there. So you got to meet this guy, Chris Dolan. He's awesome, and he knows how to rap. And you went. It was just the three of us, and you did a whole rap for us, and it was Tupac. Now You Say It Comes Full Circle, and it was amazing. That was over 10 years ago, Chris Dolan. So
that's how I get big verdicts as I rap. And Gary, I want you to know, just think Weekend at Bernie's. We're never letting you go.
Yeah, thank you. I would have to say that whatever rapping you do in a courtroom, you're getting the verdicts despite your rapping. Keep that in mind.
And ladies and gentlemen, for our listeners at home, we're going to wrap this up. But some of Gary's biggest verdicts came after his diagnosis, and some of Chris's biggest verdicts came after his diagnosis. So keep everything in perspective. Fight for justice. Fight for your family. Spend time with them. Remember, you were a person first. You were a lawyer second. But always try to promulgate change. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And remember, no sleep till justice. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you.
That was fun.
Save your tears, little one. Don't forget my friend.
Boy, you destroyed
evidence. I'll write it in.
You're going to have to edit.
Wrong,
I mean,
cite the good case law. Do the judgment and comes.
No. No, but I think we're way over an hour. You try to keep up an hour, right? Oh. Nice. You can look on.
We conferred, something's still not right. This is going to trial. No delay, no more lies, no invasive answers, and no continuance. Yeah. Drop my emotion.